This is the Zogby Report, real and unrehearsed. I'm John Zogby, pollster, and I'm joined by my son, Jeremy.
Yep, I'm Jeremy Zogby, and we're here for episode 5. It is February 9th, 2020, and what a week, you know? I mean, and since we started, five episodes in, it just seems like every week is becoming more action-packed. So without further ado, let's get right into Iowa. I don't think I can come up with a better word than debacle. So let me just ask you right up front, who's the real winner?
Well, you know, 4 or 5 days later, it looks like Pete Buttigieg is the real winner for a couple of reasons. He does end up with one more delegate than Bernie Sanders, exceeds expectations, really doesn't matter which one came in first, Bernie Sanders or Pete Buttigieg. The fact is Bernie was pretty much expected to win. Pete Buttigieg had been running third or fourth in some of the polls anyway. So he exceeded expectations, won delegates, and with the debacle notwithstanding, the polls are showing in New Hampshire that Buttigieg was a winner. So that he, in one poll by Suffolk University, has actually emerged in a one-point lead over Sanders. Remember, Sanders is the next-door neighbor in Vermont, and Sanders has been leading in the polls since November, and Sanders won over Hillary Clinton in New Hampshire by 20 points. So looks like we may have a neck-and-neck battle momentum so far, though, with Buttigieg.
So Bernie's camp, and Bernie himself, rightfully so, are upset. Of course, this happened back in 2016. A lot of people feel, I should say, happened back in 2016, that the DNC outright stole it from Bernie. I think a lot of Bernie supporters were cautious and looking out for that to happen in 2020. But I myself was caught by surprise. Let me ask you, were you caught by surprise? What looks to be a brazen move by the leadership at the DNC. How do you see that?
Well, I think you could characterize 2016 as a brazen move and possibly even make a case that Sanders actually won in Iowa in 2016. There were a couple of districts that had to be a coin toss to actually determine a winner, you know, for the nomination of the Democratic Party. This time around, everything went well until 8:30, 9 o'clock in the evening, meaning the vote was fine, the voters were fine, the head counts were fine as people raised their hands or made a check mark on a slip of paper. But electronically, it was a total disaster. We'll be investigating and debating that and coming up with all sorts of conspiracy theories. Whatever it was, it hurt the Democratic Party, not only in Iowa, maybe killed the caucuses forever, at least their first in the nation standing. But more importantly, it put Democrats on the defensive because they've got to make a case, we can do things better than Donald Trump. And if you can't even count votes, then that's really problematic for the party.
So what about the fallout of the Shadow app? I'd like to just remind some of our listeners that, well, it's being reported that Pete Buttigieg donated $42,000 towards the development of this app, that there are people who developed the app that were from the Obama camp and from the Hillary camp. And it just looks really bad. In the immediate fallout. But you mentioned earlier on that so far Pete Buttigieg is in the lead. It looks like he's going to be the winner of Iowa. He's probably leading right now in Bernie's next door state in New Hampshire. But what about the long term? If Bernie decides to drill in and say, look, you know, this is just proof that Buttigieg is the choice of corporate America, as Bernie would put it. Is Buttigieg really in the lead in the long run? And what about the fallout of this story with the shadow app?
All right, so let's parse this. The shadow app, the very fact that this is what people are talking about, including Democrats, is not a good thing. So whether there was a conspiracy or not, fact of the matter is there's buzz in social media about Robbie Mook, you know, who was chief strategist for Hillary Clinton, as one of the developers, the DNC, the Democratic National Committee, that endorsed the development of this app, and the sheer fact that it didn't work. The sheer fact also, and it is fact, it's not conjecture, that the DNC is very hostile to Bernie Sanders' nomination. And in reverse, the Bernie Sanders, even more so his people, are getting very hostile, even more so with each passing day, towards the Democratic National Committee. So what? Here's the fallout. One is that on the positive side, it's the battle for the heart and soul of the Democratic Party. We've always had this progressive left versus center left establishment split, and it's gotten pretty bloody over the years. It looks like it can be even bloodier. Number two is so Pete Buttigieg emerges as the moderate candidate at the expense, you know, of Joe Biden, as we're seeing not only in Iowa, more so in New Hampshire, at least in the polling so far, is that every vote that Pete Buttigieg gains is a vote that Joe Biden loses. So Biden is sinking right now. But, you know, so that could very well hurt a loss again by Biden. A fourth place showing in New Hampshire could pretty much hurt the firewall that he feels he's established in South Carolina, where he has strong African-American support. Now we see Joe Biden going after Pete Buttigieg and saying, hey, while I was making decisions about Afghanistan and making decisions about the Middle East, making decisions about Russia, he was dealing with lost stray dogs in a city of 60,000 people. That's now, and that's in the short run, and that helps more than anybody else, Mike Bloomberg. What in the long run, though, Democrats have the problem now of competence. You know, can they actually do things better, especially when Donald Trump touts, you know, the economy? Can Democrats clear through that noise and say, hey, look, the economy is not as great as you think? But also, this battle for the heart and soul of the Democratic Party is going to be nasty. And if Pete Buttigieg gets attacked more, that sets the stage for Mike Bloomberg. And now you got a battle royal. We know that Bernie Sanders is going to go to the Democratic National Convention in July, probably with a lot of delegates. Who would he want to run against for the heart and soul of the party more than anybody else on this earth? Mike Bloomberg, the billionaire. Hey, now it's not an esoteric or ideological sort of thing. It's very real for Bernie and his supporters. Doesn't bode well for the party, though, in November.
Well, I'm trying to see how Mike Bloomberg enters into the mix of all this. He's not doing so hot in the polling, at least the numbers that I've looked at. I'm just trying to see the scenario where and when he can come out, because right now he hasn't really had much of a breakout.
No, he's been picking up bits and pieces, depending on the polls you're looking at. He's starting to climb into double digits. The scenario, the optimum scenario for him has always been that by the end of February, and February 29th is the South Carolina primary, there is no clarity as to who the moderate center left candidate will be. We probably know, we do know that Bernie will be the progressive candidate, but Biden, let's say, does not work out, continues to fail, and doesn't do as well as expected in South Carolina or Nevada. Buttigieg emerges, but gets beaten up more and more, and we're starting to see that. Biden's going after him, Klobuchar is going after him. And so there's no clear moderate establishment Democrat. And we know that Wall Street and big money are looking at Bloomberg, not that he needs the money. That's a plus for them. They don't have to shell out a lot. But he creates the buzz that, hey, we got to stop Bernie. And who can stop Bernie? Biden couldn't. Buttigieg is maybe a little shaky. And Bloomberg is spending a ton in the March 3rd Super Tuesday contest.
Why is Buttigieg shaky?
Well, so at the moment, he's got momentum. But the establishment of the party looks at him and says, wow, is this guy really ready for big time? Just the other night in the debate that was held in New Hampshire, someone went after Buttigieg and said, hey, you couldn't even deal with the race issue in your city. How do you suppose you're going to be able to deal with global problems? And he answered, and it wasn't good enough. ABC Newswoman came back and hammered him, and he was visibly shaken by it. In fact, one report said, and I noticed it as well, he looked like a deer in the headlights. So can he withstand the scrutiny? You know, he's on an upward trajectory right now, but can he withstand the scrutiny?
Yeah, that's a valid point, because when Tulsi Gabbard called him out during one of the debates, mm-hmm. You know, they had their little foreign policy scuffle going back and forth. Of course,
yes.
Buttigieg was saying, Gabbard, hey, you went to go see a brutal dictator. You met with Assad. And mm-hmm. Tulsi Gabbard came back and slammed him on his foreign policy, to which he was visibly shaken up. But one could make the argument, and if you look into some of the big supporters that are coming out in favor of Buttigieg, Iowa makes more sense. I should say his successful rise and surprise in Iowa makes a lot more sense. There's some documents that you can look up, and one of them is a variety of NGOs, State Department figures, and National Security Counselors have thrown their support for Buttigieg. So, I can understand the notion that he's demonstrated thus far in a couple cases to look like a deer in headlights, but he's got some big backers supporting him.
He does, and that's an objective reality. He has, at least from what I've seen, about 400 of these folks, you know, foreign policy, intelligence, influencers, you know, in his corner. At the same time, that fact is being pounded, initially by Elizabeth Warren, but also by the Sanders people, if not Bernie himself yet, but by Sanders people who are saying, you're the CIA candidate. You can't fool us. Now, whether or not that is a correct conclusion to draw, what it is that is how Democrats are talking about each other. And that's not a good sign for party unity, which they're going to need heading into November, because guess who's going to seize on all of those points, whether it's Buttigieg or Bloomberg or whomever, it's going to be Donald Trump.
Yeah, and we'll wrap this conversation up with this point, James Carville over the weekend said in other words that he's sick to his stomach. All of what's going on and which you've just laid out, the party eating itself. Look, guys, you know, he's saying, let's remind everybody the objective here is to beat Trump. That reminds me of 2004. 2004, the mantra was coming from the Democrats that anybody but Bush. And that led to Kerry, and that didn't turn out so well. And you know, someone like Carville, I would imagine, and knows the history of the political landscape quite well. It sounds like 2004 all over again when Carville says something like that.
Yeah, or worse. What it is, though, is the history. You know, there's an old saying, and it's cliche now, that when Democrats form a firing squad, they do it in a circle. But you're seeing an element of that. It's getting brutal. It's getting nasty. Even, you know, if the savior of the party is perceived by the establishment to be somebody like Mike Bloomberg, that in itself is self-destructive, because we know whether or not Bernie embraces Mike Bloomberg in the end and says this is our best hope, you know, to defeat Donald Trump. Fact is, I don't think he could bring many of his people to support Bernie. Bernie is a leader, but he's not. What he doesn't have is a silent horde where that he could lead wherever he wants. These are activists and young people on a local level and campus level, and I think it would be very difficult for them to vote for Mike Bloomberg.
So in other news or in other reports, there's the buildup of the coronavirus. Since we last spoke about it, as of today, we're looking at 40,000, over 40,000 infected. It's already surpassed in a matter of 3 weeks what SARS did back in 2003 with a little over 800 deaths. We're past 900. And today, the Director General of the World Health Organization tweeted, quote, "We may only be seeing the tip of the iceberg," end quote. And that's some major development just in a matter of 48 hours.
Yeah, it is. In fact, I've been traveling today. I'm in Miami, so I didn't see the 40,000 figure. I actually saw the 30,000 figure yesterday morning. That would be Saturday morning, and that was staggering to me. So the growth is exponentially, not only in the number of cases, but, you know, in the number of deaths. And, you know, what I'm reading is what I think everybody else is reading, and you're pointing to, this is right around the corner. This is a global pandemic, and it is frightening, in fact. Just traveling, we saw today, many more people wearing face masks, even though it has been argued that that a face mask doesn't prevent transmission, or at the very least, it's useless. But this is not simply getting downright scary; it is downright scary, frankly.
Were there any testing stations in Miami International or wherever the layover was before?
No, we didn't. We haven't gotten to that point yet.
Well, I just wanted to mention one more thing, and then we can call it a wrap. So here we are at episode 5, and in the first two episodes, we talked about Iran. That was the major news, and in the next three, we haven't really talked about it, and that reflects, I'd say, a change of direction in the news. In the first episode, when I was talking about what to look for, I mentioned about the analogy of North Korea, in which we saw this song and dance, you know, of about three stages where you'd have increasing tensions. You would have, it looked like there could be some kind of action between the United States and or North Korea, followed by maybe several weeks later, some progress in peace talks. And we've almost experienced a similar situation with Iran, where it looked like in that event leading up to the assassination of Soleimani, that there was the prospect of war, and then nothing. And now it looks like tensions have eased, as you pointed out. I think that the analogy of what was going on with North Korea back in 2017 and 2018 so far has fit perfectly. I'll turn the mic over to you for any closing thoughts.
The President's State of the Union message, which happened to be well received, and his numbers are at almost record highs, did not mention North Korea at all. He did mention Iran, but only briefly. His major focus in this was on domestic issues, and in particular, making specific pitches for African American votes, which I found very intriguing and maybe something that we ought to talk about next week on our Zogby Report.
It sounds good. And thank you to everyone for joining in again. Please listen, share, and subscribe. You can find our podcast on Apple, on Spotify, and on SoundCloud. We'll see you next week.